Case for today, Gibson v. Texas Department of Insurance. I'll hear from Mr. Hogan.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. As I was preparing for the oral argument today, I was struck by something that Justice Kennedy said this summer in United States versus Alvarez, that freedom of speech and thought flows not from the beneficence of the state, but from the inalienable rights of the person. And it's under that precept that we have come here today to discuss whether a state government can assert ownership over specific words, namely Texas and workers' compensation, solely on the basis of their content, without regard to their context or the intent with which they are used, and thereby restrain others from using those words.
I guess conflict depends on what this statute says, and that is a real mystery to me. If you put 419.01, if you had joined it, or the Texas legislature had joined it with two, I might make sense out of it, but two alone is just exactly what you said. It just you can't use words together. Well, we don't need a circuit court briefs and talking about that. Has the department made any regulations? They were given authority to promulgate regulations with reference to this. Have there been any?
I'm unaware of any specific regulations that the department has made, Your Honor.
Well, have you talked to them about this name you've got on your domain?
We have.
Why and haven't you resolved it? What do they want?
They want complete ceasing of usage of the domain. And that's one of our concerns, because
what do they want you to do?
They say that they want us to choose a different domain. And they want us to choose a different name, that they do not want that particular name.
What's
that
wrong
domain
with
name
that
is.
Domain?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What is wrong with the domain? Just because it uses the words? You can't,
yes, Your Honor.
You can no longer say anything about workers' compensation, Texas workers' compensation anymore. You can't use that.
That's correct. That's their premise, Your Honor.
Well, that's nonsense. I don't ordinarily rule from the bench.
Well,
I'll be quiet for a while.
And
Mr. Hogan, let me ask,
yes,
you,
ma'am.
Did you ever make a written response to the cease and desist letter?
No, ma'am, we didn't make a written response. I made oral responses. Of course, that was not in the record. But I did contact the attorneys at the Texas Department of Insurance to find out if there was any way that this situation could be cured, worked out, resolved. And they said, no, there's not. You can't use those words. When I talked to them to point out that so many legal treatises, so many books, the Texas Workers' Comp Law Manual, which is a bench book that's published by Flahy, Bogdan, and Latson, uses those words. They said,
I'm going to get in trouble.
I worried about that too, Your Honor.
Yeah,
they said, oh, we're only enforcing it with regard to domain names. We're not enforcing it with regard to anything else. And that's one of our core concerns, because this particular domain name was used by John Gibson to provide general advice to injured workers, to people that might come, citizens that might come before the Workers' Compensation Commission, and they're using it as a prior restraint to chill individual citizens from getting that particular type of information.
Well, didn't the blog also criticize the workers' comp statute to some extent?
It did, and it criticized the Workers' Comp Commission. And it offered critical commentary on some of the judicial opinions that had come down with workers' comp. but it seems like under this statute there can no longer be spirited political discourse without violating the terms of the statute. And that's one of the reasons we have challenged the statute as overly broad and unconstitutional on its face.
Well,
what about as applied?
I believe it's also unconstitutional as applied, Your Honor, and that turns to the second prong that we have challenged the statute. Of course, the district court didn't pay any attention to the facial challenge. They just dwelt on the challenge as applied, and then for various reasons that I'd like to discuss more about in a few minutes. dispensed with that and ruled on 12B6.
I'm sort of inclined to believe you're engaging in at least commercial speech, at the very least, and that you're entitled to some level of protection and that you have a cause of action for that. I'm not sold on your facial attack and prior restraint and all that. I don't think we really need to get into that. So I hope you'll at least concentrate on what I'm thinking right now.
Sure, sure. Be happy to. And whether we look at it as applied or whether we look at it facially, the state in this case has not met their burden. And I think the question of whether it's unconstitutional or, I'm sorry, whether it's commercial speech or whether it's non-commercial speech really is kind of a red herring and doesn't need to be answered today, because either way, whether it was commercial speech or non-commercial speech, it was incumbent upon the state below to demonstrate at least a substantial governmental interest and to demonstrate that the statute was narrowly tailored to achieve only that interest and to establish that it was no more restrictive than necessary. And that test applies whether it's commercial or non-commercial.
Or at least show that there's some confusion caused by your website so that they have a right to legislate.
That's right.
A legitimate state interest.
And
I'm not convinced they do. I'm not convinced that would confuse anybody. I go on Google all the time looking for legal matters, and I get all kinds of entrees into lawyers' ads. Uh-huh. I mean, everybody knows that's going to happen when you go online and look for things.
Is this an advertisement?
No, Your Honor.
Well,
I don't believe it is.
The word ads loosely. Some of them are like your client. They're talking about the law.
Right.
Little treatises on the law or blogs on cases that are coming down.
And the courts have struggled with that. The courts of appeals and the Supreme Court have struggled with that, whether a lawyer's blog constitutes advertising or not. Interestingly, and I pointed out in the brief, the Texas Advertising Review Board of the Texas State Bar has said that a lawyer's blog is not advertising, and therefore it's not regulated by the state of Texas. But one of the biggest problems that arises under the statute is the fact that it's a strict liability statute, because as you pointed out, Judge Dennis, it doesn't require any sort of likelihood of confusion. It doesn't require even any sort of mental state that an individual must have an intent to deceive. And we find this in other statutes, those that regulate the use of the Texas Department of Public Safety name, for example, and statutes regulating use of federal agency names, that if you have an intent to deceive, then it becomes wrongful. And that's the saving grace for those statutes under the First Amendment. If someone wants to set up a private investigation company, for example, and call themselves the Federal Bureau of Investigation, then that's something that the federal law would not allow. And that would be okay under the First Amendment, because you have a requirement under the federal law that there be an intent to deceive. But on the other hand, if someone wants to publish a book or put out a movie called Stories of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, we wouldn't expect the FBI to come up and say, no, that's our name, you can't use it. Or to take it one step further, if the FBI wanted to say, no, you can't talk about federal court decisions regarding the Bureau of Engraving and Printing and the investigation process, which is exactly what 419.002 says, that you cannot use these words in any context in the same document, even the same activity or the same product.
Texas. Mr. Hogan, when you had those discussions with the Department of Insurance, did they give you any suggestion as to what you could use or how to limit or rephrase your blog?
No, Your Honor, they didn't.
And did you make any suggestions to them?
No, we didn't.
So you're stuck on your words, they're stuck on theirs.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And it's our contention that even if he rephrased the URL, that doesn't end the problem, because rephrasing the URL, and this is one of the reasons that the declaratory judgment and the First Amendment action that the court sidestepped becomes important, because even if we rephrase the URL, his blog still must discuss and must include, in order to accomplish its objective of informing the public, the words Texas and workers' compensation, which would be a violation of the statute on its face. Whether it's enforced or not, it would be a prima facie violation of the statute. And
well, if Texas could prevent you from doing this, from saying these three words, Texas workers' comp law, I guess that's four, I guess they could prevent a lawyer from putting up a website that said Texas tort law.
Sure.
Or any kind of law.
Or maybe just Texas at all.
That's probably a little too jumpy.
Well, one of the perplexing things under this statute is that John Gibson is board certified in workers' compensation law by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization.
Well, it does seem a little unfair he can corner the market on these three words, but I don't think that's before us. I don't think anybody's claiming a trademark.
Yeah. Well, the district court did analyze it under a trademark analysis, Your Honor, and I'm glad that you mentioned that while my time permits. One of the things that shows error in the district court's opinion that they used a trademark analysis is that procedurally, even, it was improper because we were before the court on a 12B6. Had we been before the court on a summary judgment motion, had there been some evidence, then the district court might have been able to even entertain those evidentiary conclusions, because the district court, referring to the line of trademark cases, relied on the fact and its conclusion that the Texas workers' compensation phrase has secondary meaning. There was no evidence before the court. There were no studies before the court to show that. There was no indication of a likelihood of confusion. So procedurally, at least, the district court should have denied the 12B6 and held it over for an evidentiary review if the state wanted to make those challenges and those types of assertions. One of the cases that has...
He's looking at the statute. He doesn't have any room to move in.
That's correct. That's correct.
Doesn't matter how many meanings it can be given the words.
Well, and if he wanted to go down the trademark analysis, I think he would have had to have that. One of the cases that's been discussed in the briefs is the San Francisco Arts case, which has to do with the use of the words Olympic. And distinctions highlighted in that case, they had substantial evidence before the court on an evidentiary basis, on summary judgments, that there was secondary meaning, there was inherent distinctiveness in the word Olympic in that particular case. And the Olympic Committee also showed that they had developed and marketed and used that phrase for financial gain and promoted that phrase. There's been no such showing here that the Texas Department of Insurance Workers' Compensation Division has invested any money in promoting this phrase, in causing it to acquire secondary meaning. And that has not been pled below.
You said this isn't an ad, but isn't it really an attempt to attract more clients?
It's a bifurcated attempt, a twofold attempt, on the one part to inform the public and also to lead clients to his website indirectly and to promote his services. And in that case, it's similar to some of the pamphlets that were discussed in the Bolger case, that where the Young's drugstore had pamphlets regarding contraception in general. And then down at the bottom, they had the Young's drugstore name. And the Supreme Court said in that case that those are protected speech because they're not purely for a commercial purpose. They're also for an informative and an educational purpose, and afforded those a higher degree of protection under the First Amendment. And we would submit on the basis of our briefs that, and on the basis of the argument, that it would be appropriate for the court to reverse and render this case if this court finds the statute unconstitutional on its face or if there is sufficient evidence for the court to find it unconstitutional as applied, and that if the court is unable to reverse and render, that it should at least reverse and remand. Thank you.
What about abstention? And let Texas try to give some meaning to this statute.
I'm out of time, Your Honor. May I have additional time?
You're answering my question.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Under the abstention theory, and they have argued for Pullman abstention, that would be appropriate if there was any leeway in the statute, if there was any way that a reasonable court could interpret it.
That's a point.
But it's a strict liability statute. It's not ambiguous.
All right. You've given an answer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you. May it please the court, James P. Sullivan for the commissioner. And I'm here today on behalf of the state of Texas, hoping to give some reassurance to the court. The state of Texas is not trying to stop all use of the words Texas and workers' compensation. Judge Reveley is not going to be in trouble as a consequence of today's oral argument or the resulting opinion in this case.
You've got to give a different meaning to this section of the statute.
I'd like to try to do that today and to try to explain why the statute is not nonsense. If you look at 419.002A, it becomes clear that the words Texas and workers' compensation are not barred from any use in any general discussion or anything like that. The restriction on the use of these words is tailored to a particular context in which the Texas legislature thought that the combination was likely to deceive the public by evoking the official name of the agency responsible for administering Texas's workers' compensation
system.
The word
deceive is not in the statute.
Well, the word deceive, a variant of the word deceive is in the statute for the definition of deceptively similar.
That's not in the statute. That's the prior section.
Yes, in the definition.
Those aren't related, except they're joined and one succeeds the other one.
No, I don't.
If 09 referred back to the prior section, that would make sense, but it doesn't.
419.002A does refer back to the definition of deceptively similar in A4. Any combination or variation of the words or initials or any term deceptively similar to the words or initials described in subdivisions 1 to 3. And so I think that the context here of the statute.
That's in the disjunctive. That's or. After having said you can't use the words, then it comes down there at 4 and says any term deceptively similar.
Yes, and that's correct.
But deceptively similar to the other words. Not deceptively similar in the sense that 001 would relieve it, that a reasonable person would think that it's sponsored or authorized by the state.
I think that the definition of deceptively similar in 001B makes clear what the Texas legislature has determined and what it has done in 002, and that is that it has identified.
Counsel, I'll go this far with you. If you can get the Supreme Court of Texas to say that's the way they read that, I'll accept that construction of the statute. But I sure can't construe it that way, and I think it's an irrational construction. The way it reads now, it is just simply using the words. There's no deception required for you to do anything with it.
Well, but even there, Your Honor, it's only the use of those words in a particular context where the potential for misuse of the division's name is likely, and that's actually the section heading for 419.002, misuse of division's name or symbols prohibited. The statutory trigger in 002A talks about the specific context in which the term can't be used, and that is in connection with any, and then there's the list of commercial speech, types of commercial speech, made or offered by the person regarding workers' compensation benefits. So there's nothing in here that suggests
any product or any service regarding compensation benefits, trying to educate the public.
I don't think that those could be construed as such, but even if they were, Your Honor, I think this gets back to Judge Dennis's good point about the need to focus in this case on the as-applied challenge rather than on the facial challenge. The potential overbreadth or extent of this statute should not be decided by the federal courts in this case as a consequence of the Pullman abstention doctrine.
I don't believe as-applied law means applying it differently without any support in the words themselves.
No, I think that the as-applied challenge here, we should be trying to decide whether the application of this statute to prohibit Mr. Gibson from using the domain name TexasWorkersComp.com, whether that application violates the speech clause of the First Amendment. And I submit to you that it does not, for the reasons that we've stated in our brief. We think, as suggested by Judge Clement's question, that this domain name is, at most, commercial speech. And commercial speech, which is a relatively recent entrant to the protection offered by the speech clause, commercial speech does not receive protection under the speech clause if it is inherently misleading. And we submit that in this context, used this way, it is inherently misleading for Gibson to put his blog up under the domain name TexasWorkersComp.com. And my friend in opposition has essentially nearly conceded as much in his brief. On page 46 of the blue brief, he says that the only thing missing from the domain name that would have made it inherently misleading is if he had put the words division or, I think, commission into the domain name, then it would have been inherently misleading and thus not protected by the speech clause. But we think that the combination and the Texas legislature's determination was that the combination in this context.
What your argument is that any state agency that has regulatory powers over something Texas could prevent a lawyer from putting up a website, like, say, Texas oil and gas law. The Railroad Commission could, if legislature passed a law and said you can't use those words, there would be no protection.
An application that would prevent a website.
In the absence of your showing a lot of misleading, confusion, and bad things happening because of it, which you haven't shown.
Well, I think that you're exactly right, Judge Dennis, that there has to be some, if we cannot show that the speech is inherently misleading, such that the application would not even fall within the speech clause's protection, then indeed we would have to go back and make a record to show that it was either actually misleading, or if it were potentially misleading, then we would have to go through and satisfy the central Hudson test. And we've conceded as much in our brief, that if this court disagrees that as a matter of law, this application with the domain name TexasWorkersComp.com, if you disagree that that's inherently misleading, then you should remand the case and then we'll have a chance to make a record to show that we can satisfy the central Hudson test I'm sorry?
Can you show that substantial government interest?
I think that we could show that substantial government interest, Judge Clement. And I think the substantial government interest would be the avoiding confusion on the part of the public that consumes workers' compensation services in Texas. It's a population that, I mean, we can't count on the general public of Texas to have the sophistication of Fifth Circuit judges when they get on every website. So even if you yourself, Judge Dennis, aren't confused when you get on Google and you see all of these different things, we're trying to protect a broad segment of the population from being misled into thinking that they're going to a website that represents an official communication from the division or the department responsible for administering the workers' compensation system in Texas. And so if we go back to make a record, we'll be trying to show that we have a substantial government interest in rooting out that kind of misleading or deceptive speech, and that we have a reasonable fit between the means and the end.
And how would you show that?
Some of the suggestions from this court's cases, perhaps there could be survey data. We could talk to the legislators about what they had in front of them when they determined that these things were deceptive or misleading. It could look a lot, for example, like what happened in the Friedman case in the Supreme Court. We're talking today about I think maybe our expectations about deception are a little too high. In Friedman, for example, the deceptive speech that the Supreme Court held could be prohibited was that Texas could prohibit optometrists from practicing under a trade name because practicing optometry under a trade name was actually deceptive and therefore not at all protected by the speech clause of the First Amendment. And so too here, we could go back and say, legislature, tell us what you had before you and why you thought that a combination like this, or either combinations generally of Texas and workers' compensation in a term, or specifically in this case, why the division found this to be a deceptive misuse of the division's name.
What is this, his website end? What's the domain?
It's .com.
Com.
Yes.
Well, doesn't that in itself tell you that it's not a government website?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Governments, I think you're referring to the top-level domain name like .com, .gov, .edu.
My email ends in .gov, which indicates
right.
I'm part of the government.
But this is actually not a universal practice. On the way over here, for example, having worked with my colleagues in the Florida Attorney General's office, I was reminded that their website, I believe, is myfloridalegal.com, and then you'll go to Attorney General Bondi's website there. So it's not the case that it's always .gov and that that's the kind of blue ribbon standard for coming to an official communication. But even if that were true, unless that is something that's going to alleviate confusion on the part of everybody, then I think that we would still have both a substantial interest to further and also a domain name that wouldn't be protected by the speech clause.
Well, what happens next? You sent the cease and desist letter.
Yes.
Instead of filing a written response, there were some conversations. And then this suit got filed.
About 2 weeks later.
What do you do to enforce this? Is there a penalty or a fine? Or what happens to Mr. Gibson if he doesn't take the blog down?
Probably the likely enforcement mechanisms in this case would be that either an administrative penalty would be imposed by the division. And then that penalty would be subject to judicial review in the state courts of Texas.
Does that mean a fine or?
I think it's a $5,000. I think it's a $5,000 penalty, is my recollection. Also, the Attorney General's office, of which I'm an employee, can be asked by the division to go into a state court and seek a civil penalty. I believe it's also $5,000. This gets back, though, to a good point that Judge Clement raised in a question. And that is that when Gibson received this preliminary cease and desist letter from the division, which invited him to engage in a process where we would try to determine whether there really was a violation here, whether there was something else that could be done, 2 weeks later, we're in federal court. Instead of going through state administrative proceedings and then going into the state court to try to get just the sort of construction of the statute that Judge Reveley would have some comfort were he to be given that by the state court.
Well, what happens if you file the written response? What's the procedure? Instead of administrative procedures.
I believe that he would. I'm not sure that there's anything codified. And so.
Those are your words. Administrative procedure. What are you referring to?
I guess what is codified. I assume that it would probably be a somewhat informal exchange. He could explain to us why he didn't think he was violating the statute, or during the administrative process, he could say, I think that this particular application is protected by the speech clause of the First Amendment. And if that's true, my friend in opposition in the brief says that they are not allowed to raise First Amendment claims on judicial review in state court, but that's simply false. They could raise that. And so he could then, if a penalty is levied against him, then he can seek judicial review and will be in state court, and we can then get an authoritative construction.
But there's no administrative hearing. You still have to involve the judiciary.
No, I'm sorry. There would be a hearing. I'm being too imprecise here. There is a process for a hearing under the state's general, you get a hearing under the regular kind of Administrative Procedure Act in the state. And then that is subject to judicial review in a state court.
And who's the hearing officer? Who makes that decision?
I think that the hearing officer would be from the State Office of Administrative Hearings. But presumably, ultimately, it'll fall at the feet of my client, in this case, the commissioner and his staff, to make the determination whether there's a violation here. But we never saw any of this happen because we went straight to federal court instead. And that's why, in this case, as I think Judge Dennis pointed out in a question, Pullman abstention makes it appropriate to wait until another day to pass on the facial challenge, because the statute is susceptible to an authoritative state court construction that would completely eliminate the need to decide the facial challenge under the First Amendment overbreadth doctrine. If, as I submit to you in my capacity as an officer of the state of Texas, if this statute is limited only to commercial speech, then the First Amendment overbreadth doctrine doesn't even apply, and then there will be no need to decide the facial challenge. And so because that's true, Pullman abstention is completely appropriate, and the district court certainly didn't, as a formal matter, say that he was engaging in Pullman abstention, but that's effectively what happened. And even if it isn't, even if you could ask District Judge Cummings, were you doing Pullman abstention, and he said, never even thought of it because the state never mentioned it, this court could still raise that sua sponte as an alternative ground for affirming the dismissal without prejudice on the facial challenge ground. So if I could come back, I think, to our argument, because I, in the reply brief, I've not yet really fully seen what the response is to this argument, to explain why we think that the application of this statute that would prohibit TexasWorkersComp.com as a domain name, we think that that does not violate the speech clause because it is commercial speech that is inherently misleading. Some of the questions were directed towards determining whether the domain name is commercial speech, and I think that the district court correctly characterized it as commercial speech. In the amended complaint on page 73 of the record, Gibson has described, he has essentially complained.
If we disagree with you and think that it's not inherently misleading for a lawyer to put up something like this, what will we do? Reverse and render?
No, I don't think you would reverse and render. I think that if you disagree that this domain name is inherently misleading, then I think that you should still affirm in part as to the facial challenge, the equal protection, due process, and takings claims. And then as to the as-applied challenge, I think what you would do is reverse the grant of 12b6 dismissal and remand for further proceedings so that the state and Gibson would have an opportunity to make a record to show whether this is actually misleading or not, whether it's potentially misleading, and whether the state can satisfy the central Hudson test. And we've conceded that in our brief, because if you don't agree as a matter of law that this is inherently misleading, then we have the burden and we still have some more work to do that hasn't been done yet because of the procedural posture in this case.
So anytime Texas wants to put people to a little trouble, they can pass a law that says you can't say the words oil and gas, Texas oil and gas law, or Texas oil and gas, or Texas whatever, and there's going to have to be a trial on whether or not that's inherently misleading. Is that right?
First of all, I think there would be a big disincentive for the state to do that because I don't.
I would hope so.
I hope that you won't assume that the legislature, who I represent, and the state will be intentionally going out of its way to violate the speech clause of the First Amendment. And in any event, the potential for attorney's fees and the significant, you know, resources that the state spends on defending these kind of suits, I hope will give you some comfort that we don't do this wantonly. We don't do this to suppress any kind of political speech. We do it instead, as a lot of other governments do.
Are there any other statutes like this?
Other statutes like this, some of them have been mentioned.
No, I mean in Texas.
Yes. For example, in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, there's something about not allowing them to use the state seal. I don't know that there are others like this about other agencies. I think on the federal level.
Just taking three words of a generic field of law and saying you can't put that on your website.
Well, I don't think that we've said that you can't put it on your website, Your Honor. I think that we've said that you can't use it as part of some commercial speech advertising a particular type of services. So it's important to remember here that the Texas Department of Insurance has not in any way suggested that Gibson can't criticize the department or the division or talk about workers' compensation law.
You're saying he can't have this website.
No. He can have even the website. He cannot, we submit, cannot use the domain name TexasWorkersComp.com.
What can he name it?
He could name it LoneStarWorkersComp.com. He could name it anything that won't give the misleading impression to users of the Internet that this is an official communication from the Texas Department of Insurance. And again, we have essentially a concession on the other side that there are some things that would be inherently deceptive. For example, they are not challenging the other parts of the statute where we say that you can't use Texas Department of Insurance and things of that nature. And that, I think that's a sensible concession on their part, because that is exactly the kind of inherently confusing thing that we don't want to allow. And so,
but that's much more specific.
It is much more specific. So this is, we're definitely to the harder part of the statute. And so if you don't think that in this context, using TexasWorkersComp.com is inherently deceptive, then you can send it back. But as Judge Dennis suggested, I think the kind of cornering the market and looking like you're an official source does carry the potential to confuse the public.
Well, Mr. Hogan, your time's up. You've done a good job. I'm sure you're a good lawyer. Next time you come, I hope you have some merit on you.
Thank you, Judge Reith.
Now, will the real Mr. Hogan please come to the podium?
No problem.
And you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. And
you don't have to use it, counsel.
I understand, Your Honor, but there are some important things that I would like to point out. Just so there is no confusion, and if I conceded anything in my brief that my opposing counsel indicates I may need to humbly retract it and take it back. I believe that the state's argument might have more merit had we used a term like Texas Division of Insurance or Texas Department of Insurance.com or Texas Division of Workers' Compensation.com. They might have. But I don't want to leave the court with the misimpression that that would still cure the statute, because even the portion about the seal, even the portion about using the division's name, in order to be constitutional, still must carry some requirement of a likelihood of confusion or intent to deceive. And that's absent from the statute. The legislature could have put that in there if they had wanted to. They could have required that, as they have in other statutes, but they didn't. And I thought this was a case of first impression until last night. I came across an opinion, and I'll submit this to the court by means of a Rule 48J letter. Last fall, the Western District of Virginia faced a similar issue with regard to an ordinance prohibiting the use of a municipal seal. And that case was Rothamel, R-O-T-H-A-M-E-L, versus Fluvanna County case. And in that case, they pointed out something which is critical to our examination today, that legislatures know how to draft exceptions to prohibitions for protected First Amendment activity. And then they went on to hold that the statute in that case, like our statute, because it was a strict liability statute with no allowance for any sort of fair use, no allowance for any sort of political discourse, was in fact unconstitutional. My opposing counsel has also suggested that the state is not enforcing this except with regard to domain names, and that even though the statute might prohibit our discussion here today, none of us are going to be in trouble. But I would urge the court not to consider that, and not to consider his representations, even as an officer of the court, to be an appropriate limiting device, because the case law says that courts must be careful not to invade the legislative domain and shouldn't rewrite a law to conform it to constitutional requirements, and that just this notion of trusting the enforcement agency under some sort of noblesse oblige, as we pointed out in our reply brief, to enforce the law fairly, even though the law has been unfairly written, does not render the law constitutional. In regard to your question earlier, Judge Clement, about whether there were any regulations, a quick search that we did just a few moments ago reveals no regulations that have been promulgated in the Texas Register concerning this particular statute. The statute merely is what it is, and it's a strict liability statute that prohibits a substantial amount of otherwise protected speech. And also importantly, in that statute and in the legislative history to the statute, there was no evidence. And it has been held that whether you invoke a strict scrutiny or whether you invoke an intermediate scrutiny, in order to show a substantial interest, the government has to have some evidence to justify that, evidence that was considered at the time the statute was enacted. There is no evidence, as my opposing counsel mentioned. They have not developed that yet. So that inherently shows the unconstitutionality of the statute. And that was one of the key holdings of the Illusions Dallas versus Steen case. And I believe you wrote the opinion on that, Judge Clement, that a regulation, a law which touches and concerns or may have some adverse impact on First Amendment activity has got to have some reasonable evidence considered by the legislature in order to justify it.
Well, he was referring to maybe going back and conducting a survey or something like that.
Sure.
Did that make sense to you?
It did, and those surveys should have been done back when the law was enacted, or they should have relied on surveys from another state.
There's nothing in legislative history or no?
No, ma'am. There's nothing in the legislative history.
Thank you, Mr. Hogan.
Indicate that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Take case under advisement.